As you know, the days are getting shorter and darker and colder. It's the time of year when winter begins to creep in, and also the time of year when we look for things to make us feel a little more warm and comfortable. One of the best ways to do that is through a little dose of self-indulgence. The food writer and Morning Edition regular Nigella Lawson has some thoughts about self-indulgence. She joins us from London to talk about them. Hi, Nigella.
Hello. I'm very, very pro-self-indulgence. I'll be up front now.
I had a feeling you might be, although we should emphasize that in the United States, self-indulgence, I mean, kind of got that Puritan heritage over here, it's considered bad.
It is considered bad, and in a way, you could say that only heightens the pleasure. So your negativity is not entirely negative, we should say. I mean, I think that we feel that self-indulgence is bad for two reasons. I think one, that people are kind of diet obsessed, and the other, of course, as you say, it's a puritanical feeling that somehow if you enjoy yourself, there must be some moral slackness.
Well, let's just dive into some moral slackness here, if we might. Because once again, our colleague, Courtney Dorning, has baked one of your recipes here. And just at first glance, it looks like a cross between a pancake and a toasted cheese sandwich. I believe it's called donut French toast. What is it?
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. It's the right sort of color.
Oh, my gosh. Really, it's amazing.
It's really...
Excuse me, this is just amazing. It's like a donut, but it's French toast. But go on, please.
Yeah,
please.
No, well, I think the reason why I think of it as a sort of donut is because the egginess and the vanilla come through, and
yes,
then you put sugar on top, like a donut. And there's something, I don't know whether this is true, but someone once said to me that vanillin, which is the thing that makes vanilla smell like it does, is present in breast milk.
Oh.
So we have some very primitive desire to be comforted by the taste of vanilla. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm just telling you. So you could say it's a kind of Freudian self-indulgence.
I had a mouthful of it when you were saying that. It's really more than I needed to know. But thank you anyway. I appreciate it. It does taste like it's got almost like a donut glaze on it. It really is quite a treat. It's really great.
Well, sugar, you know, sugar is enormously comforting. And I say that as someone who finds all food comforting, including savory foods.
So how do you find a balance, or do you even try, between enjoying something a little rich from time to time and actually, you know, going overboard and being unhealthy?
Well, I think the balance is much easier to maintain if you don't deny yourself all the time. I think people who forbid themselves to eat anything that's been fried or that has butter are the ones that suddenly manage to eat tubs and tubs of ice cream.
Mm.
Whereas I think the body is self-regulating. There are times when you want something fried and then you feel like a very light soup or a plate of steamed vegetables. I mean, I actually feel I eat very healthily. My only problem is I eat enough for five healthy people. That's it's a portion control issue. But I do think it is okay to eat foods that the dietitians say don't eat. I also think that one should make a real distinction between self-indulgent foods that are real foods and processed foods which have all sorts of things in them which aren't good for you. So as long as you're cooking proper food for yourself, I don't think you need to feel so bad about it.
Well, that's interesting. It sounds a little like Michael Pollan, who's been in this program many times, talking
yes.
about, you know, something that feels natural, something that your grandmother would recognize as a food rather than a food product of some kind.
No, I think he's quite right there.
Now, you've also got, if you don't mind, I'm going to eat the other piece of this donut French toast.
Carry on, crunching.
And as I do that, yes, it does have a crunch to it. It's really really crispy. It's great. I wonder if you could describe another recipe you've got here. I don't know if this would go with a donut French toast, but if you would describe the cheddar cheese risotto, please.
I would be delighted to. I don't think it does go with it, but I think it has a lot in common, even though, of course, the ingredients are very, very different, which is, I suppose, self-indulgent foods are reminiscent of the tastes we loved in childhood. So just like the eggs and the milk and the sugar in the donut French toast, the cheese risotto, the cheese melts and becomes sort of gooey. So I suppose it's like a slightly grown-up grilled cheese sandwich, but there's something about carbohydrate, which you cannot beat carbohydrate for comfort. And even though I at first felt, I felt bad about, you know, the Italians, and why am I putting cheddar in a risotto? But an Italian friend of mine says that whenever she goes back to Italy, they ask her to bring cheddar back because, of course, for them, they make a choice between cheese that has a flavour or cheese that goes gooey. Now, cheddar has a strong flavour and also goes gooey, so it's kind of perfect.
Mm, but not something that would be on a traditional Italian plate.
Oh, not at all. But I think that my notion of self-indulgence perhaps isn't entirely the same as everyone else's. And what I love about this dish is you can sneak a few minutes in the kitchen and just stir. And sometimes I find that the best way to switch off. So I'm really in my own little world stirring something and then I'm eating it. I do think also anything that can be eaten out of a bowl with a spoon is a fantastic self-indulgence. No cutting, no chewing.
Mm, there you go. Excuse me, I was just chewing some more of the donut French toast there. Is there anything to avoid when you're putting together some self-indulgent food like this?
Well, I'm afraid there probably are things you should avoid, but I don't know that I know how to. I suppose you don't want to have them every day. You don't want it to be a pile-up. And also, I think sometimes people confuse comfort eating with misery. So there is no point in indulging yourself if you're going to persecute yourself at the same time. That is what you have to avoid.
What do you mean?
If you don't enjoy it because you think I shouldn't be eating this, then don't. If you can wallow in the pleasure of every single mouthful, then you're doing something good. And then I think then somehow it's healthier. No, it's not healthier. It doesn't make any difference nutritionally. But I think the mind is important as well as the body.
Nigella Lawson, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Nigella Lawson is the author of several cookbooks, including most recently Nigella Christmas. And if you'd like to indulge yourself at home, both of these recipes are on our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. As the swine flu spread, so do the questions about it, as well as rumors. Many of you are emailing questions to us, and our own reporters are hearing more questions in the field, especially from parents, pregnant women, people with other health problems, in other words, the people most at risk. And today, in your health, we're going to answer some of those questions with our health correspondents, starting with NPR's Richard Knox, who's in Boston. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Steve.
I understand you've been spending some time at a pediatrician's clinic.
Yeah, I went out to Needham, Massachusetts. It's a Boston suburb, and I hung out for a while at the offices of Dr. David Greenis and his partners. It's a real busy place right now. The receptionists say that a lot of people get really mad. Some of them even lose it because they just can't get the vaccine. This is Marilyn Hapeny.
Some people have even apologized for being so nasty to us, but oh boy, I mean the three of us went home last week and cried, truly. Just being beat up all day long.
Meanwhile, people are getting sick at a greater and greater pace. Several nurses are taking calls from parents of sick kids. This is Nurse Nancy Clegg, and she's talking to a mom with a 2-year-old sick boy.
Well, you know, it could be the flu. It could be, you know, a virus. You know, we're not testing specifically for H1N1.
The pediatrician here at Steve, Dr. David Greenis, says that 9 out of 10 parents who come in have flu questions, no matter what they came in for.
Probably the biggest questions we get are, number one, people want to know how will they recognize if their child has the flu.
Which is a natural question because the symptoms could be similar for swine flu, regular flu, or just a cold, I suppose.
That's right. You'd think doctors would know what's flu, but it's really not very easy to tell. The flu has certain hallmarks. One is a really ache all over feeling. It really knocks you out, and that's an effect that a cold might not have. And in terms of treatment, well, the good old-fashioned things are usually just fine. It's fluids, bed rest. But that advice isn't enough for some of Dr. Greenis' patients. Let's listen.
Some people have asked me really with sincerity, what can I do so my child won't die if my child gets the flu?
Terrifying question, but a fair one. People have died.
That's right, Steve. And so far, almost 120 children and teenagers have died around the country from this flu, and that's way ahead of most flu seasons. The most important thing that parents can do, Dr. Greenis tells them, is be vigilant. Few kids get into trouble, but it does happen, and even with healthy kids, it happens, and it can happen fast. So they need to be aware of some danger signs. Trouble breathing is one of them. If a kid is hard to wake up, if she's lethargic, if there's persistent fever, a really important one is if the lips are bluish or grayish. Greenis says basically, though, that parents should trust their intuition. They know their kids best. Call them if they're worried.
And what else did you hear of the people who had brought their children into that doctor's waiting room?
Well, I talked with one fellow named Jim Wilson. He's a real estate man, and he says the whole family, the whole Wilson family, is just getting over the flu. And he wishes that he'd known one thing earlier.
We weren't told all the ancillary infections you can get from it. The ear aches, the sinus problems, the strep throat, all these side infections.
So that's why, Steve, the doctors say they want to know if you don't get better within 5 to 7 days, or you get better and then get sick again. These are all signs of possible infections that come on after the flu, and they need to be treated.
You know, you mentioned that Mr. Wilson's whole family had the flu. I'm thinking of my brother, where most of the family has been sick, but not quite everybody yet. Should we assume that whole family is going to get sick?
Not necessarily. One mother in our pediatrician's office who came in with her two little girls asked an interesting version of that question. Her name is Stephanie Payne.
I work in a child care center, and my children attend a child care center. So I think my main concern is if one child gets it, how quickly it could spread through an entire center.
Well, we all know that flu can sweep through an entire daycare center or a classroom, but recent research shows that when somebody gets sick in a household, only 1 in 4 of the household members will get sick on average. The pediatrician here, Dr. Greenis, says that he's known couples who didn't share the virus, and he's known kids who didn't infect their siblings.
Although this leads to another question, because I have heard from people who've had swine flu or been diagnosed with swine flu who said, give me Tamiflu, give me that flu medicine, let me do what I can. Is that a good idea?
There are different philosophies on that. The official advice from the CDC says that Tamiflu should be considered for anybody with a condition like asthma or diabetes or other chronic diseases. Dr. Greenis, the pediatrician we talked to, is more conservative. He says that, you know, some kids have stomach problems with Tamiflu, and he doesn't want to make them feel worse. And other doctors, you know, worry about having too many people on Tamiflu because the virus might become resistant.
NPR's Richard Knox is in Boston, where he's been getting answers to some people's questions about swine flu. And we're going to bring another voice into the conversation now, our colleague Joanne Silberner. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Steve.
And where did you listen to people's concerns about the flu?
In Washington, D.C., and this was going to give you a little bit of an idea.
Welcome. Thank you so much for coming out to DOH's H1N1 mass vaccination clinic program.
That's at Kelly Miller Middle School in Washington, D.C.
Right. So what we need from you is to please be patient. We're going to start letting people off in 5 minutes.
There was a line. There's definitely a line, and there is a shortage of vaccine.
And so who's allowed to get the doses, at least at the place where you were?
Well, generally speaking, it's pregnant women, people who care for very young children, healthcare workers, people aged 6 months to 24 years, and people 25 to 64 who have chronic medical conditions.
I guess you saw people who fit into at least one of those categories then online, right?
Oh, yeah. And here's one of them. This is Jacqueline Geller.
I'm currently 8 months pregnant, so I'm here to get a flu shot. And I have a daughter who's 1-year-old, so she's here to get a flu shot as well.
You know, we got an email from another mother. Her name is Tara Lund. She's in Portland, Oregon. She's got a couple of young kids, 6 months old, 2 years old, and this is her question. If they get the flu before the immunization is available, should they still be vaccinated?
Yeah. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says yes. Unless Tara Lund's kids were tested using a very precise test for H1N1, she can't know for sure if the flu that they had really was H1N1 swine flu, or maybe even not a flu at all, maybe a cold or something else. And if they get the vaccine and it turns out that they actually did have the flu, there's no real downside there.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned testing, because I've heard stories of people who've had what is believed to be swine flu, but they were never tested by the doctor, as well as people who have taken the test. Why would not everyone be tested if they went to a doctor?
The office test is really imprecise, so you don't know if you get a yes or a no and if that's correct. The good test costs a couple of $100. It's not widely available around the country, and it won't make a difference in how you're treated. You know, if you've got fever, aches and pains like Dick described, you still need to rest, get plenty of fluids, and stay home.
What other questions did you hear?
Well, the pregnant mother, Jacqueline Geller, raised an issue that we also hear a lot about from listeners.
Well,
another friend of mine asked me today, she had heard that there was mercury in some vaccines, and she wanted to know if it was safe because she's pregnant as well.
Okay, is it safe?
Yes.
When you get the vaccine, the H1N1 vaccine, from a multiple dose vial, it is preserved with something called thimerosal, and that does contain a form of mercury. That's true of the standard seasonal flu vaccine as well. It's very little mercury, less than you'd get in a can of tuna. And now, it's been said before, and I'll say it again, numerous scientific studies of vaccine have failed to show any connection between the mercury in vaccines and autism or any other problem. But if you're still worried, there are two mercury-free alternatives. Some H1N1 vaccine is available in single doses, and that doesn't contain any preservative. And the nasal version of the vaccine also contains no mercury.
So mercury doesn't present a problem, and even if it did, you can get the vaccine without the mercury.
That's right.
And by the way, we're still hearing sounds of that vaccination clinic in Washington, D.C., where Joanne did some interviews some days ago. And, you know, in all the questions we've received, there is one question that nobody asked, but it was very much on the mind of my daughter. Does the swine flu shot hurt?
Well, this young expert said it stinged a little bit.
Thanks very much. That's NPR's Joanne Silberner, and we heard earlier from NPR's Richard Knox. And you can go to npr.org for answers to more of your questions about swine flu. And that's your health for this Monday morning. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. On top of everything else it does, Google has gone into the phone business. Google Voice is a way for you to make phone calls. That has raised the question of whether Google is a phone company, and that question is not just semantic. The answer determines if Google has to be regulated in the same way as a company like AT&T. The dispute is now before the Federal Communications Commission. The issue is a controversial practice that enriches some rural phone companies in a few Midwestern states. NPR's Howard Berkus explains.
First, a warning.
That stuff about the rural carriers and whatever, it doesn't get more complex than that stuff. I mean, if you really study this stuff, you go blind.
That's Scott Cleland, a consultant and analyst for telephone companies like AT&T. But not to worry, the story will not blind you or send you screaming from your radio, I promise. I hope. Let's start with a simple phone call. This is something millions of people do every month using one of those free teleconferencing services. A lot of those calls like this one go to phone numbers in Iowa.
Welcome to the conference center. Please enter your conference ID followed by the pound key.
Now, these calls are routed through certain rural phone companies because they're allowed to charge higher fees for the calls they process. This stems from federal policy fostering competition and rural phone service. Long-distance providers pay the higher fees, and the rural phone companies and teleconferencing services split the profits. In Spencer, Iowa, for example, one phone company with just 800 potential local customers handles 2.5 million calls a month.
We host and cater to many large conference calling companies, companies that vary from 24 channels to capacities of 7,000 and 8,000 channels on a single call.
Josh Nelson runs Spencer's Great Lakes Communication, which doesn't actually serve any local customers. Long-distance providers say they pay millions of dollars a month more when calls are routed through these small towns. It's all perfectly legal, but critics say the practice also involves sex-oriented chat rooms, and it games the system. This is where Google Voice comes in. The company's Rick Witt says the scheme burdens Google's new and free computer-based phone service.
There were a very small number of exchanges, primarily in rural areas, where there were an inordinately high number of calls. The volume was way off the charts. And the costs were way off the charts.
So Google Voice began blocking those calls, and Josh Nelson at Great Lakes Communication noticed.
They were blatantly blocking probably tens and tens of thousands of numbers.
Google Voice won't connect to that teleconferencing service I called earlier. It now blocks about 100 selected phone numbers to such services, says Google's Rick Witt.
We realized quickly that if we allowed this to continue, the free nature of the service to consumers would be threatened because something like 26% of our costs overall were just going to these few exchanges in these areas.
Members of Congress with rural districts howled in protest, as did AT&T. because blocking calls with high fees gives Google Voice a competitive advantage. In fact, phone companies can't block any calls. Google considers itself a computer company providing a phone application.
In a sense, it piggybacks on top of your existing phone connections. And it's also, it's a web-based application. It's all out there. It's software on the web. So it's not using the traditional phone lines and traditional phone networks the way the legacy carriers do.
But Scott Cleland, the consultant for phone companies, looks at the service provided, not the way it's provided.
Clearly, Google Voice does things like a telecommunications provider does. It enters the game by creating an application. But on the back end, it has to connect people, much like a telecommunications company does. So which is it?
The Federal Communications Commission is considering whether Google's call blocking is permissible, and it's tackling that fundamental question. As phone and computer technologies converge, who will provide which services under what rules? Stay tuned. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
The Wonder Chef David Chang is crazy for noodles. Ardent, obsessive, devoted, fanatical, all the adjectives apply. Noodles are the centerpiece at his signature restaurant, New York City's Momofuku Noodle Bar. And when it comes to noodles, Chang is more than a chef. He's part historian, part anthropologist, and part evangelist. And that's the big part. He's developed a devoted following. It's not unusual for lines to form out the door at all hours of the day at Momofuku, his minimalist noodle shop. Momofuku is the name of Chang's new cookbook also. It's written along with Peter Meehan, and it explains not just how to cook the food at his famous restaurants, but how he developed that obsession with noodles. And David Chang joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your signature dish at Momofuku Noodle Bar is ramen. For people who think of ramen as the hard little packs that come $4 with the little foil flavor pack, that's not what you're talking about necessarily. When you talk about ramen, help us understand what you're thinking about, what you're talking about, what you're serving up at Momofuku.
Well, that was actually, you know, my first introduction to ramen is the same thing. And instant ramen, cup of noodles, or there's a brand in Japanese called Ichiban, and Korean it's called Shin Ramen. And these are all instant ramens. Contemporary ramen is totally different than what most Americans think ramen should be, and there's a variety of types. And when I lived in Japan in Izumi Tottori, I was introduced to the cult of ramen. I was sort of floored because people would queue up for 2 to 3 hours. And contemporary ramen right now is like called wafu ramen. It has a lot of dried fish and pork and chicken. You know, ramen's not one thing. There's many, many different types.
Yeah, you have an interesting equation. Ramen equals broth plus noodles plus meat plus toppings and garnishes.
That's it. That's simply it. And I think that's why people love it so much. You know, when they created instant ramen, it was a smash because it was so accessible. And who doesn't like hot broth and noodles?
Now, you have a recipe in the book for ramen broth, which is quite a bit removed from those little flavor packets that you often use to flavor ramen. This is a long and arduous process. It starts with konbu, which is the dried kelp. It also includes 4 pounds of chicken, either whole, bird, or legs, 5 pounds meaty pork bones, 1 pound smoky bacon, best quality you can get your hands on, scallions, onions, carrots, a little bit of, you could use kosher salt, I guess, or soy sauce, you say, or mirin. This takes hours to do this. I mean, you have to let the pork bones, for instance, simmer for 6 to 7 hours, just, you know, at that step, which is step 6. There are a few steps beyond that. Help us understand why it's worth it to put this much time and love into that special broth.
But it's worth it, but to me it doesn't seem like it's that much. Granted, it seems like a lot of ingredients, but you're making a tasty soup with different layers of flavor, and all you need is a big pot and just throw a bunch of the ingredients in and just let it simmer. As you're cooking it, remove some of the ingredients as you go along.
And then strain it.
And strain it.
I want to ask you about the ginger scallion sauce,
sure.
In part because it sounds like it's something that's, for someone who's busy juggling on things, looks like it's pretty easy to do. And there's a picture that accompanies the recipe that just looks so delicious. And it looks like the way that one should eat ramen, bent over the bowl.
Well, it is an amazing sauce that we use at our restaurants. I would say it's almost omnipresent. You take ginger, you finely mince it, you take some scallions, you chop them up, probably a cup of scallions, a tablespoon of ginger, quarter cup of grapeseed oil or some type of neutral oil, salt, maybe some soy sauce, mix it up, you're ready to go.
That's it.
That's it. And what's great about it is that it's a cold sauce. It's not cooked. So when you add it to hot ingredients, the heat brings out the aroma of the ginger and the scallions, and it just smells great to me.
And just a squirt of this maybe on
Yeah, it's not really
pork
squirtable.
Roast,
it's more like it's more chunky, like a salsa or something.
Okay. All right. And again, that keeps for how long?
Hopefully it won't stay that long in your fridge because you'll be using it so much. But cover tightly, and if it's in the oil, if it's covered in oil, should a couple weeks tops.
That's New York chef David Chang, owner of the noodle restaurant Momofuku. The restaurant is named for the creator of instant ramen noodles, Momofuku Ando. David Chang will be back tomorrow to talk about his accidental specialty, pork buns. But before we leave the subject of noodles, we want to hear your ramen noodle stories. Was there a period of time when that was all you ate? How do you dress up your ramen noodles? Do you skip the foil packet and use your own broth? Who among you uses ramen noodles in their hard, crunchy, uncooked state? Well, tell us all about it. Go to npr.org, click on Contact Us, and make sure to put ramen in the subject line.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Well, now to, if not an internet language, an internet writing style, the style of Twitter. Getting your point across in 140 characters takes some skill. And David Gorn has this story on particularly skilled tweeters who've used their talents to find work in the rough economy.
Jen McCabe says she got her current job in San Francisco through being an avid tweeter.
I absolutely would not be where I am today without the following and support of the people that I meet on Twitter.
In fact, she's been called the queen of Twitter among her healthcare colleagues. McCabe used it to become an expert in a niche field inside the healthcare industry and would tweet updates from conferences, comment on breaking news. Powerful people in that niche field started to notice her and follow what she had to say.
Twitter's a meritocracy. You are known for what you tweet. If you come across as a smart, hardworking person, people are going to pay attention.
That's one way to get a job. The other way to use Twitter and other networks like Pounce and Jaiku is to simply network. These sites used to be used mostly by youngsters, but life on Twitter has changed. A significant percentage of users now are 30 and older, and they're using Twitter to find jobs. That's according to Josh Burnoff of the Forrester Group, a technology research firm.
The thing that makes a difference for people looking for jobs is the ability to retweet.
That's when people pass along your tweet to other people in a different network. Burnoff says it's a cyber extension of the adage, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
That creates a real echo effect for people who've got friends that have a lot of friends.
Rich Trombetta has another idea. He co-founded a site called tweetmyjobs.com.
We connect job seekers and job posters instantaneously via Twitter. We take the noise out of the Twitter sphere.
The idea is there may be dozens of companies you want to follow on Twitter, but if you get every piece of info those companies tweet out, you could be swamped. So Trombetta filters out only the job-related info and sends those out as alerts. Microblogs, he says, are not just for fun anymore.
You're going to start to see that perception change as more and more businesses realize that this could be the most powerful tool since email.
So if you're job hunting, it's not who you know or even what you know, but how you type it. 140 characters at a time. For NPR News, I'm David Korn.
And for more tech news, you can always go to the All Tech Considered blog. That's at npr.org/alltech.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The two Tsavo lions were man-eating cats that, according to Colonel John H. Patterson, ate 135 people who were building a railroad in Kenya in the late 1890s. Patterson was the British engineer who shot the lions. That incident inspired the 1996 movie The Ghost and the Darkness, in which Val Kilmer played Patterson.
Everything is collapsing on me. Every morning the ground is soaked with blood. The workers feel I brought this terror since it didn't begin till my arrival. Whatever I try, they seem to know. All the deaths are on me.
Well, after their man-eating days were done, the lions were stuffed and put on display at the Field Museum in Chicago, where much was made of those 135 human meals. Now, a new report says the lions might not have been quite so bloodthirsty as originally thought. Justin Yackel of the University of California, Santa Cruz, is one of the researchers who wrote the report, and I asked him, based on his research, how many people the Tsavo lions actually ate.
We put the most likely estimate to be about 35, but it could also range between 4 and 72. Those values are just not as likely as 35.
Now, how on earth do you measure the number of humans consumed by two stuffed lions more than a century later?
Well, we used an analytical tool. Basically, we utilized the chemical signatures in their bone and hair to work back their most likely sources for those chemical signatures. Specifically, we were looking at ratios of stable isotopes, which are unique among different kinds of animals, and they're retained in consumers of those animals. So if you think of each prey as a different color of paint, the predator would be mixing the paint in a certain way. And so we were calculating the most likely contribution of each color to make that particular mix of paint that we were seeing in the two man-eating lions.
And your conclusion is there wasn't so much representation of the human color as to justify the 135 kills number.
Right, and this is where things get interesting, because not only did we think that, well, perhaps they weren't consuming as many humans as they reportedly did, but also perhaps the two lions had very different diets according to our analysis. So only one of the two lions was gaining any significant nutritional benefit from humans. The other was obtaining its food elsewhere.
Now, I read that the period of supposedly eating 135 railway workers took place over a period of 9 months. If indeed the lions had only taken up eating railway workers very recently, would their hair have disclosed that? What if it had been just something that they'd started doing late in life?
We were taking advantage of the fact that different biological tissues incorporate dietary information at different rates and over different periods of time. So we analyzed both bone and hair tissues from the lions. Hair gives you a dietary window of about 3 months or so, whereas because bone turns over at a much slower rate, you can get a much longer time window. And so we estimate that to be at about 6 years. And since the lions are only supposed to be about 7 or 8 years old based on their dental records, their bone values are basically a lifetime average. The bone values and hair values were not the same. So when we look at the isotopic values of their hair, for one lion, they move towards relying on human prey to a much higher degree. And we estimate that to be at around 30%.
So now you and your colleagues have to write the revised screenplay for The Ghost in the Darkness to get the number of kills down to scientific reality.
I don't know. I think it'd be hard to beat 135 in terms of telling a scary story. So I think we might not be competitive on that front if we took the number 135 and changed it to 35.
Well, Justin Yackel, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Justin Yackel of the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's one of the researchers who rewrote the story of the Tsavo man-eating lions.